Welcome to Cloudlandia, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Jackson. I would know the voice anywhere.
Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Yeah.
Another beautiful day.
Yes, it is. For you, winter is very grudging in Toronto. It gives way very, very reluctantly to spring.
That sounded so poetic there. That's really great.
Yeah. I mean, we've been the last couple of nights, we've been down to 30. Fahrenheit temperature.
That's no good.
It's demoralizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you've had a taste.
Yes, indeed. But, this is my 77th spring, so I should get used to it right now.
Well, it's always springtime in Cloudlandia.
Yes, indeed.
Perfect temperatures.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed the 2 days that we spent at Genius.
Yes.
I thought Howard Getson just did a fantastic job of moderating.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, it's a really kind of a glimpse that I got into the way he thinks, in foundational kind of principles. See that like the way I saw some new applications for AI. I love his version, amplified intelligence is really what that is, because it's not creating, it's building on intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so, I was very excited about it, because I think it's going to lend itself well as that exercise that he had us go through of, the progression from what you know kind of thing to how you could use it as a tool internally to help you do what you do. And then to think about how you could use that to create something that could be done in the market. And that was a nice progression, because I thought, I was thinking about certain things that I have within, I've been working from my 8 profit activator model for a long time. And so there's a lot of diagnostics and a lot of best practices kind of things that I have within those that are transferable. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. one of the things I have is a seven step checklist for, really gauging the success of an ad. And that, as I look through those, it could recognize and diagnose maybe the, where this, the opportunity for this ad to be better or to be where it's kind of weak. And so I think about that as a tool. Is a pretty interesting thing.
Yeah, well, algorithms, that's really what, our thinking processes really are. And they're really useful algorithms if anybody can plug in the information and more or less get the same kind of beneficial result from it. I mean, that's one of the tests of an algorithm, that not just the person who created it gets a result, but just showing someone else how to do this thinking process, they also get, a result that's similarly beneficial to them. And, and I'm always looking for that. I mean, my sense is that, anything can work for us. I mean, if you think about yourself, you've got your own methods inside of yourself in the think, and it works. You figured out how to work. The big challenge is, can you get it work outside of you?
Well, that's the thing is I look at the two, the layers of the especially if I take my 8 profit activator model, that the, I look at those as sort of, there was a difference between the heuristic and algorithm, in that the heuristic of understanding the 8, what the 8 profit activators are and how to kind of point yourself in the direction of guiding your thinking about them, to then when you apply them to create an algorithm that you can use in your business, you know. And so there's two layers. A lot of what I've done, a lot of the value that I create is by figuring out the algorithm for a particular industry or for a particular situation that can then be licensed or, you know, deployed for multiple people. You know, like when, when I do the, for what I've done in real estate and with a lot of the financial advisors and things where we've figured out how to do something in a local business that then I can, you know, replicate, do that same thing in other local areas. That really removes me. That's a way to remove me from from the things. As I look at
from the how, you
know. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I look at the being at the lab here in Winter Haven and cracking the codes, creating the, you know, being an algorithm factory in a way, and then having it multiplied throughout, you know, in all the other situations that it can go. And that's what I'm really, that's what I'm excited about, really figuring out for me going forward. That's my, I think that's my sweet spot, you know?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, you know, I mean, you're, I know I will be successful when it's actually an algorithm for you. That's actually, you know, that's, and one of the things I find, you know, I have similar, I haven't put it into the form that you've done it, but I've got sort of a, you know, a set of rules, and I kind of, you know, in that little exercise where we put down, you know, that the mindset, it was health and half, and I did it. And to a certain extent, I've got some conditions that have to be met if I'm going to be interested in something new, you know. And one of the things is that I'm more of an innovator than I am an entrepreneur. Okay, yes, and what I mean by that, what I mean by that is, you know, the whole notion that I could get a cookie cutter for life. In other words, that I would create something and it would just be good for life. It would constantly grow. And there, you don't have to improve it. It's just, you know, it's you don't have to improve it at all. I would get bored with that in about 3 or 4 days.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would too. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the, you know, we've used the example of my model of Max Martin, the song producer, that, you know, if I write the song, it's like the last thing that I would want to do is spend the next 2.5 years singing that same song all over the country every day. You know what I mean? That's not for me. And that's really what—that's really what you're saying. I got to keep innovating, right?
Yeah. And you have to take that into consideration, that it will kind of make you unhappy, you know. And you know, and some, you know, people say, you know, if you could, it's like the whole thing that you could create an automatic band, you know, you could get an AI program that's it's a kind of band, and then the AI program could just be answering questions and running programs. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, geez. I said, I would subvert it. I would sabotage it. You know, I would find some way to destroy that AI. And I think it's, you know, it's a personal thing. It's sort of, you know, at the core of us, I mean, compared to other people, all of us are idiosyncratic. In other words, we got our odd things, but it's the odd things that give meaning to us.
Mm-hmm. I think the greatest thing is, you know, from an observer now, longtime observer of your model, is you, what I think is attractive about it is you've got a stable platform and context in that there's quarterly workshops and you're working with entrepreneurs and there's some constants that are there, but the variety of every quarter is a brand new workshop that is like adding the variety into it. And whenever you get, you know, when you've done a program for a few years and kind of adopted or figured out the thinking tools and the progressions for it, you're leaving this wake behind you of you moving up to the next level here and having, as soon as it gets to where other coaches could, facilitate what you've created there, you keep moving forward. And that's exciting, right? That's kind of the...
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of like a frontier, you know, it's sort of, sort of a frontier approach. And the thing is that you want to have some lasting value of what you've created before, but you don't want it to make demands on your future. In other words, I like creating foundations and, you know, having other people benefit from the foundations, but I don't want it to inhibit my desire to see what's over the next hill.
Yes. That's right. You don't want to set out, you don't want to set up camp in the valley kind of thing, right? The train is moving. Yeah. You're leading the caravan. It's moving. It's definitely moving.
Yeah.
That's kind of the cool thing.
Yeah. But I think it's, you know, I think we're very similar. I think the two of us, I think why we enjoy our conversation, because each of us is open to discussing something new that we haven't really figured out, and we can do it together. But we do have the ability to almost institutionalize the good part that we've created before.
Yes. Yeah, I love that. Like setting up because I do love, you've really been influential for me on this, is thinking about, I love enduring contexts. That's something that is, I love to get to the baseline of things that we're establishing, things you can depend on going forward. But I also love novelty, and I love the way that all the things, I love how seeing that intersection of the, you know, our fixed context that we figured out applied to the new information, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I just think that, you know, that desire of institutionalization on one side and novelty on the other, are kind of in tension with each other, because you can have a little bit too much of either, and it makes the other side kind of uncomfortable. But, you know, when I look at, you know, kind of how humanity, you know, if you look around the world, I mean, you know, the population of the world is 3.5 times now what it was when I was born. And, you know, which is, I mean, that's a big deal. That's a big deal to have lived a lifetime where the population of the planet increased by 3.5 times. It's a big deal. And, it seems to me that, things kind of work, you know, like the news media doesn't think so. I mean, the news media kind of makes it, makes its money off things that they can point out aren't working. But in fact, I bet, you know, if you ignored all the nervous Nellies who were pointing out what wasn't working, you'd have to observe that probably for about 90% of the planet every day they get up and, you know, things kind of work. Things kind of work, you know. Have enough food, got shelter, you know, got friends, enjoyed their company, got some new things you're working on, you know, and everything like that. And you know, the sun comes up every day. It's kind of predictable. Yeah. It does what it's supposed to do. And I think most people kind of have a pattern to their life, and they get up every day and things sort of work. And it's the vast majority of humans. And that's what gives other people the luxury of complaining about things.
Yeah. And you've been, I don't know what it is, Dan, but I've had this, like, just this, I don't know, funny, like, just this view on things that if we look at, it hasn't been until the last 100 years, say, that it seems like there's so much more, I don't know what, in our society, in the way that people can exist and make money and our economy, the things that we have, there's a lot more, like, I don't want to say silly, but I mean, there's a lot of, like, really, you know, esoteric. There's a lot of things that are non-essential, let's say, economies or ways that people are making money. You know, when you think about how it all, this cooperation game that we're all playing, that there's a lot of the things that are happening that don't really have any, I don't know that they're fundamentally contributing to what you were describing there, the base need. You know, we're definitely, as a society, moving into the self-actualization as a planet kind of thing. You know, we've basically solved the basic things, the for the most part.
Survival and safety.
Yeah.
Coming up, I mean, if you take Maslow's pyramid from 70 years ago, whenever he created that. And, you know, and all the statistics that come out of, you know, the international organizations that keep a track on those things, you know, the poverty level, the, you know, the really bad things that can happen to human beings level, things have really, really dropped down. Generally, and I think the reason is because left, given the freedom to do so, people kind of cooperate more than compete or conflict with each other. You know, people find it easier to cooperate than to pick fights.
Yeah. And that's what's made us such a successful species, you know. But the ability to do that, And it supports so many, you know, alternative ways of making money and surviving in the world. You know, like when you're thinking about, there are people who make money as a Lincoln historian, for instance, or things that, you know, telling tales of other past.
It was really interesting because I was sitting listening to, this is for those who were listening to the podcast, we had, Dean and I were at Genius Network, and which was created by Joe Polish, and Joe is taking a year off. He's taking a sabbatical year off, and he's got visiting moderators who are coming in and guest moderators who are putting together sessions. And we just came off 2 days where a colleague of ours and in Genius Network and a colleague and strategic coach, and he put together really a beautiful program over 2 days, 7-8 different people. But one of them was a cousin of his who was a scholar on Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. And it was really, I found it very, very stimulating. But I was sitting there and I was thinking, I said, you know, this is really great, but why are you teaching 19, 20, 21 year olds this sort of stuff? I said, why don't you, put this into a program? I said, this is really good stuff. And there was a lot of originality to his treatment. He was taking Lincoln stuff and then he was creating new thoughts about it, And I was sitting there and I was chunking out thinking processes and, I could pick any one of those letters that he showed of Lincoln's, which are private from Lincoln's personal journals. There's a really neat thinking process there. I found it very impressive. First of all,
I did too. I was saying that even, for the first time, I've never thought of Lincoln as a real guy. Person. Exactly. And I thought of him as this character.
When they chisel your face on a mountain face, it's a little harder for you to connect.
right.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because, my five heroes, my five historical heroes.
Let me see if I can remember. So we've got Gutenberg. We've got
Gutenberg.
Let's go all the way back. The Bach and Shakespeare and James Madison.
Okay.
And is there anybody earlier?
Yeah. Way.
Yes.
Euclid. Euclid. Together geometry. And then Euclid. the last one, number five.
Number five is, what century are we in?
19th.
Okay, in the 19th century.
19th and 20th, early 20th. Yeah, Edison.
Okay. Edison, that's it. So that was pretty good. I got...
Yeah, no, you did really well. You did really well. But I was going back and looking at Euclid, and I was reading a whole series of essays on why Euclid's so important. And his influence was really great. As a matter of fact, I could make a statement here that probably in terms of his thinking and also what his thinking was used for, he's probably made the biggest impact on the planet simply because everything that's built on the planet has to follow Euclidean geometry. And there's one thing, one thing that is a fundamental rule that nature only respects 90 degree right angles.
Right. I remember we had that conversation about the ROM, ROM Museum.
I'm just waiting, this year, maybe 5 years from now, 10 years, but it's going to crack and fall apart.
That's right.
Because every day nature says, we moved it a quarter of an inch. I think, and it's these modern architecture, which, they put them at odd angles. The moment you put that odd angle of, build something at an odd angle that's 90 degree right angle, nature is trying to pull it down. And you'll find after a while, whatever your original costs were for creating this new structure, your maintenance costs at a certain point are greater than your original costs.
That'll be, so this is, we got that to look forward to in our file.
I think there's lots of structures, not just physical structures, but like thought structures that aren't solid enough to withstand, you know, the gravitational forces of, human novelty and human experimentation and human, some things we like to do over and over and over again. And there's some things we like to do maybe once or twice, and then we try to pull them down. Yeah. And I share with you, I like things that kind of last, you know, that I can really bet on.
Yes. Yeah. Like Euclidean geometry. That's right.
Yeah. And there's very interesting. There's actually a statement that is credited to Euclid. Everything is what it is. I have to get this right. Things are, I think this is how it goes. Things are exactly what they are, and they're not something else.
Right. Things are exactly what they are, and they're not something else.
And they're not, and they're
that's
not something
true.
Else. I said,
that's
true. Yeah. Boy, that's really true. But think about the things today where people are trying to make something seem to be something else, you know, like they're trying to make history be something. So there's always these fights over meaning that human beings have, you know, that this means this. No, it doesn't. It means this. And then we get into fights, you know, over the meaning of a word or the meaning of a context. Yeah. And, it's like one of the things I often notice is in the political realm where people are saying, you know, this is absolutely anti-democratic. You know, this is not this is a violation of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they're talking about, you know, the United States. And I say, well, actually, you know, if you go back and you look at the original, the original discussions and the original blueprints for the country, it's not designed to be a democracy. It's designed to be a representative republic. They never used the word democracy in the founding papers. The founding fathers never used the word democracy. They didn't like democracy. And democracy means, everybody gets a say. And they said, no, we want some people to have a say. I mean, really, fundamentally, where you have the Electoral College, we'll let you have a say inside of your state, but your state will only count for one vote. Okay, so there's this tension. There's this tension built right into the country. But if it was
well, it's kind of interesting when you think about it like that. Then I mean, it really, I hadn't thought about it like that. But that's where you can then sort of, gather. Where in states that are particularly the way you want to live, kind of thing.
You're living in the most promising state in the country right now.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
I picked well.
You know. Yeah, you chose well. You know, you chose wisely.
Chose wisely.
And 20 years ago, California was the state to be, and so it shifts around, and you vote with your feet. I mean, a lot of people just vote with their feet.
Yeah.
And a lot of New Yorkers right now are moving to Florida. They're voting with their feet.
Yeah. I saw something that broke down the personality types of, by geography, like where, when you think about why the Midwesterners are so sort of agreeable, is you know, that they are, they wanted to get away from the Northeast kind of thing where it was all the, they wanted to get away from the city kind of things. And they headed out away from that. But as soon as they hit any adversity, like before they got to the mountains kind of thing, they said, oh, this is good enough. This is good enough. This is fine right here. This will do right here. And the, you know, the pioneers are the ones who headed out to California, which is why all the, you know, personality-wise, adventurers and innovators and freedom and, you know, I guess you could say the, you know, kind of fittest and adventurers kind of thing are out west. It's really interesting.
Babs has got a family history that's interesting in that respect. So mid 1900s, she had ancestors from Michigan. Babs grew up in Michigan, and there were two brothers who went west, and they got into the California Gold Rush near Sutter's Creek, 1849. Unlike a lot of people, they had a strike and they got gold, and they immediately packed up and went back to Michigan and built themselves a town.
Wow!
And the town is on Lake Michigan, so if you think of the lower part of Michigan, it's got a lower and an upper part.
Yeah.
If you're going up the west side of it, you're in Lake Michigan, and it's certainly true. And right at the top of the west side of Michigan is a little fishing town called Leland, and they're on a kind of a, you know, a whole area that's called Leland now, but it's Leland, and it was a fishing town, and now it's a big resort town. It's a Cape Codish type of town. And they build it, you know, and they build it from scratch. And they've always, you know, for 100 years, they had the central store in Leland. And that's where Babs' mother's family comes from, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because you think about people going out and having a gold rush and hitting it rich. They wouldn't come back. These people came back. You know, they had gold and they had enough gold to start a town. And so they came back and of the town.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
That's something. Not, you think about the people who went out west and just struggled but kept reinvesting, trying to find more and more.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something.
Yeah. Yeah. The frontier, you know, I've read a lot about the frontier. The frontier in the U.S. lasted 270 years from 1620, which is the first permanent settlement, Jamestown, Virginia. Uh-huh. And then it took 270 years to go all the way to the West Coast. And what they use as the sign that the frontier was over is that all the land was surveyed. So when we got to the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, there was nothing that was still territory. Territory was generally speaking, something was territory when it wasn't surveyed.
Unknown, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't surveyed. They knew it was a big piece of land, but they hadn't really given any internal thought to it. You know, they hadn't actually put any lines, boundary lines, and everything like that. But the moment it happened, 1890, there began to be this worry that the spirit, the DNA of America, was involved in this pushing west, and now they were at the ocean, and they couldn't push west anymore. So there's always been this sort of worry, now we won't be who we're supposed to be.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
And, but it's kind of like, you know, that's funny, the accomplishment kind of mindset of, if you take California, like just some of the you know, most successful financially people who can really live anywhere. That's funny that they push as far, that's as far as you can go kind of thing. And they all accumulate there on the coast in California with the best weather in the country, the best, you know, best of everything. So it just keeps, they settle there and make things, they push. I think there's something to this frontier spirit kind of thing. That that frontier is where they kept new things going, like built on, you know, now that we've conquered or I've got all the land sort of frontier. Now the frontier is in entertainment and then later in technology. And
psychedelic drugs.
Well, that's true too. Yeah.
No. I mean, San Francisco, you know, that whole West Coast. I mean, I was in the Army in 1967 in Korea, and I was, you know, I came back in May of 67, and I had a brother who lived in San Francisco, so they flew me back to Seattle, and that's where I was discharged. I was just discharged from the Army and at the air base where I was, I landed. And then I had travel money home. That was part of the deal. So I went to San Francisco, and it was interesting because it was May of 1967. And the very famous summer of 67, there's kind of this, it's a bit like Woodstock, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's one
was
of
that
those. Your,
was that the dropout, turn on, tune in?
Yeah, well, this is the beginning of the hippie. The real hippie thing was a psychedelic and that.
Yeah.
And that was the summer of 67. So I was there about a month before it started. And we went to Haight-Ashbury, which is it's a section of San Francisco. And you could get stoned just walking down the street there. The marijuana was so thick and everything. Of course, it was illegal too. There was this attraction of the illegal aspect of it, and it was kind of funny having just been 2 years in the Army and then coming face to face with this culture that was as radically different as you could possibly imagine.
Right.
And I just found it interesting, you know. And my sense is that the makeup of America, and I've got this theory that it's actually created itself through the states and through the Constitution into 50 R&D labs.
Ah, right. Yeah, like Vermont is a different vibe than yeah, right? I mean, that's the whole
yeah. And they all there's actually quite a bit of freedom. There's actually quite a bit of freedom in each of the states to, you know, they first of all, they can control their own tax laws. They can control, you know, the all sorts of laws. You know, I mean, some of them are, you know, have, you know, they're, you know, sort of pro-choice states, and then there's pro-life states, and then there's marijuana states, and then there's no marijuana states. And, for example, one thing, if you're a Canadian from Ontario and you go across the bridge into Detroit, one thing, they just stop you and they say, do you have any drugs? Do you have any marijuana? And people say, because we have national marijuana, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Canada now, I think. But Michigan's hasn't passed marijuana, so they'll turn you back. They said, if you have marijuana and you don't tell us, we're going to seize your car and you're not going to get your car back. They'll tell you right there, you know. And
oh my goodness. Wow.
This will use up the next 5 years of your life trying to get your car back.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But it really shows you, and it drives Canadians crazy because Canadians generally do things on a national basis. And but the U.S. doesn't. It does it on a state basis.
Yeah. Yeah, like that's interesting.
Your governor took a totally different approach to COVID than some of the northern governors, like the New York governor. And the,
that's you know, true. It was very freedom oriented here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my feeling is he's got more of a feel for the pulse of who his citizens are than some of the other states, you know. And Florida is very diversified. I mean, if you take all the different historical trends that have made up the present day Florida population.
I wonder how that's going to affect, like, I wonder what's happening where, you know, our growth, Florida is poised to grow by, to 29 million by 2030. Yeah. And so yeah. We're growing, you know, 1500 people a day right now. And that yeah. pace is going to continue for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Which means, you know, we're growing, a city the size of Orlando every year.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing, but I wonder how the makeup is going to change as a lot of that is migration from the Northeast. So from mm-hmm. sort of blue states coming down into our red
yeah,
state.
The question is, the question is, are people social attitudes, cultural attitudes, political attitudes,
right.
Internally based, and that's who they are, and they're going to simply take that, or it's more a function of who they're hanging out with, where they are?
I wonder, because it's interesting to see what's happening in Texas with the California yeah. migration. They're all saying, the big T-shirt is don't California, Texas.
Yeah.
Don't get your California in our Texas. You know, that kind of, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. But my sense is that the makeup of the states and the way they put them together and, you know, with the states' rights really makes it kind of a turbulent place. I mean, because they look at each other, the states look at each other, and they compete with each other. They'll compete. Part of the reason why a lot of people are coming to Florida is because Florida is directly competing with New York. You pay these kind of taxes? You don't pay these kind of taxes here.
No,
you don't pay these kind of taxes. You're not coming down here. You can still keep, if you want to keep your condo in New York City, that's fine. But as long as you're down here for a certain number of months, then you can be a resident here and you don't have to pay there, you know. Mm. And and it's cold up there.
That's no good. I don't like that at all. I'm not a fan.
Yeah, it's cold. It's cold.
Yeah, no, yeah. That's not for me.
See, we're both 10 quick starts, but I really like cold weather. So I'm sort of a cold weather guy. I don't mind the cold.
What's the appeal, Dan? What is it that you enjoy about the cold weather?
You know, it's kind of, you know, the images that you have in your mind. I just had a really great childhood on that farm in northern Ohio. Uh-huh. And I used to just love going out and walking through the fields, in the dead of winter. And it kind of, you know, it just kind of made an imprint on me. And walking through the woods and everything. So I've got all these really fun childhood memories.
Yeah, I don't mind that. You're right. There's so many, and there are the majority, but not, I don't know the majority, but a lot of winter days are nice. And there is something there, but then there's February and, you know, just like that whipping wind and the bitter cold. I don't enjoy that at all.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And the slush, you know, when it turns slushy.
Yeah. That's no good.
But the thing is, that, you know, you design your lifestyle for, you use a lot of different ingredients to, to design your lifestyle. And, one thing that I feel very, very strongly, the type of company that we have created, you know, I'm talking about the team members that we have.
Yes.
I don't believe that I could have, we could have created this company in the United States.
No. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely.
There's a permanence, you know, I mean, people live in Toronto. They're not thinking about moving somewhere else. But if they live in Chicago, they think about living somewhere else. You know, I mean, Chicago's, you know, a really big city. And
where are you going to go? When you're in Toronto, you've made it in Canada. That's like the, where are you going to go from there? You're right. That's absolutely true. Yeah,
and so I think that, and the other thing, it's a vibrant, growing city. I mean, Toronto is.
The great dispersion now that the, you know, that people are, because of Cloudlandia, now able to live in Moncton or to live in Sudbury, you know, or Kappa's casing and be an equal contributor to the team.
Well, you know, we're going to discover something here because, you know, because we're shooting for October now. That, you know, we'll, this is our plan, you know. This is our plan. It's not necessarily the government of Canada's plan or the government of Ontario's plan, but this is our plan. And anyway, and therefore we'll get the team back around August. You know, so the October would be workshops, and August would be having our team back. And we're finding that they kind of liked it at home.
And I think that what's going to happen, Dan, it's an interesting...
They said, you know, if I could quote them, they said, oh, I really miss being around people and everything. And I said, well, okay, well, while we're all coming back to work on August. And they said, wait a minute. I really like working from home.
Yeah.
So my feeling is the transition back is going to be more complicated than the... you know, the quick transition from in-person to, we did that. I mean, that took us about 2 weeks to get it right backstage.
So right.
It took about a month to get it right in terms of the workshops. I got a feeling the movement back is going to be a lot more complicated.
But there's also going to be just the dynamic. There's an interesting, there are some synergies and, you know, serendipities and excitements that happen because of everybody being in proximity in the same room, in the same environment. And you can't, in the culture of the, you know, the team kind of environment. And working remotely, you almost, it's hard to replicate that by Zoom. But the people who are going to be resistant to coming back like that, I think the unintended consequence of that is companies are going to realize, okay, if you're choosing to be a remote worker, they're putting yourself in a category of global accessibility. Now, remote worker can mean anybody in the world who can do what it is that you do. And I don't think that for a lot of these positions, there are people in other parts of the world that could do the job that they're doing for less than what they're sort of, you know, going to be demanding to do the job remotely. That's going to be, interesting.
I told, you know, I've been talking to Babs because I'm not really involved with the management of the company. You know, my whole focus is, you know, what's going to be on stage next quarter. You know, that's my, you know, what are we doing new and better next quarter? But the thing that really struck me, and I told the, you know, we were announcing to the entrepreneurs. I said, you know, we're shooting for October. And they said, well, you know, is it going to be full in-person workshop? And I said, you know, I think it's going to take us a year after we have our first in-person workshop back. So let's say we have it in October. I said, yeah. I think it'll take until the following October to really figure out the way the entrepreneurs want it. Now, I said, we're going to have to get a full year under our belt and just look at who showed up where and, you know, what the requests were and everything. And I said, you know, I don't think you can know that ahead of time, because I said, everybody's coming back, having adjusted their life in a different way than was true before the shutdown. And I said, so it's not like there's one way that people adjusted. I think there's, you know, there's 2,500 ways that people adjusted. And we're going to see how that plays out in terms of, and I think it's the same for the team too. You know, I mean, I discovered that some people were spending 2.5 hours a day commuting morning and night, 2.5 hours. They got those 2.5 hours back. You know, so I mean, that's like 12.5 hours a week times,
I know, what a world, right?
That's that's like 500, you know, it's like 500-600 hours. And they got that back over the last year. And I said, getting that amount of time back and still being able to work and still be able to pay, I said, I bet it changes your brain cells so much.
Yeah. And I think that's so, it's very, this whole thing, that's the great thing about the, you know, the Cloudlandia workforce kind of thing, that, you know, having that, the Cloudlandia tools that allow people to collaborate like that. It truly is a frontier. It's interesting. Every word you choose is not random. And there's really a thought that goes into the free zone frontier. It's a really interesting.
Well, you know, it's you know, and my sense is that we associate it with physical frontier, you know.
Yeah.
But in fact, if you don't limit it that it's just about finding new mainland, you know, which has really been what it is, or going to another planet, but to a certain extent, you're operating in with a physical sense of frontier. Yeah. But you think of it from a standpoint of a psychological, intellectual, emotional frontier, you know. And I think entrepreneurs, for example, are, in terms of livelihood and occupation and lifestyle, radically different, have a radically different makeup than people who see the future as finding a job and keeping a job and you know, growing in a job. I think it's radically different psychologically structured. You know, a lot of the bother in the world over the last year has really been about employment and non-employment and everything else, you know. And you know, you realize after you've been at this for about 50 years, 47 for me, 47 as an entrepreneur, I mean, you just don't think in those terms at all.
Yeah. And it truly is, what I discovered in the 80s, that, you know, playing tennis, every shot makes somebody happy. And you talk about even... It's like you say, other people's bad news is your good news, you know, but in tennis, it's the same thing. Every shot makes somebody happy. And the best position to be is the umpire, to just be able to view it as either in or out, neither good nor bad, you know. And
in chess, the best position is to be the chessboard.
Yes, right. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But that was from who knew those life lessons? You know, that came from a guy, Galloway, wrote a book called The Inner Game of Tennis.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what that came for. What a wonderful life lesson that was. Very funny. Have you got any, have you been observing who's kind of adapting to the free zone frontier? You've got some, your eye on some free zone collaborations to that are happening?
Well, I think the one, you know, that has suddenly emerged for me during the Genius Network is with Howard. Because Howard, that was all new thinking. He had never shown me any of that thinking before until I got the worksheet. And I said, you know, I'd like to collaborate with you on this. And, provide, I've got a capability that I can add to your future with that. And actually two, one is we're every quarter we're adding about three or four new free zone people now, you know, starting to flow. And I said, and some of them have technology-based things where they could really use this type of thinking. And I would, just introduce them, it's like introducing to any outside, any outside thing that would be good for them in terms of growing their business and growing their collaboration. And so that's the other thing. And the other thing is I'm really, really good with tools. And, what I noticed as I was going through Howard's thing, there's some big jumps required to get from one column to another, I was seeing some bridges, bridge tools that you can get people with bridge tools. One thing he can make a lot of use of is that backwards thing that he did, is 10 times backward, the sheet of paper that he just had the drawing on. He showed us the drawings. And I always start there. I always go back and see what the history is, because there's a, you can impose trends on history. You can say, well, this was the most important thing. This was the most important thing. This was the important thing. And, and I have disagreements with people about that. They say, well, yeah, but you just said that those things were important. Were they really important? I said, well, it's our say-so that makes anything important or not important. I said, it's not like there's some rules someplace that you're going to go.
There's no official committee that appoints importance on something.
It's like you got to submit to the province to get permission to arrange your thoughts in a different way. Well, the Chinese are trying. This is their big, project to see if they can get you to, can change your thoughts without permission.
Right.
But the thing is, I found a lot in it. I went through that. And I filled in the top, the line straight across, and I filled in the first column top to bottom, and the top line right across. And I said, I got a lot out of this. I mean, it was reaffirming what I already knew. It had that power to it. So I really liked it. I'm a sucker for those sort of things.
Yeah. I was noticing when the thing of how I've used, you have this too, but I seem to have a really good recall of experiences and facts and things that are useful. In that I draw from at all times when I'm overlaying my 8 profit activators on something. So I've got all of these other experiences I'm kind of scanning quickly all of those experiences, it would be, I was thinking about how a way of cataloging those experiences as, you know, there's the consulting firm McKinsey. That's one of the advantages that they have, is they call it the work or whatever. The people, but what, I forget what they call it, the body of knowledge or the
it's called the knowledge.
The knowledge, is that what they call it? Okay.
Yeah, the London, the black cab, the London, they're the ones that start. Okay. It's called the knowledge. Yeah, it's okay. The knowledge. Yeah. And before we give you a medallion that says you have to prove that you have this knowledge. It takes about 3 years for the average applicant and everything like that. And we have that in Coach. I mean, we have this massive amount of thinking tools, and that's why I wanted to integrate it using Who Not How as the. I think Who Not How is kind of like the enzyme of Strategic Coach. You can look at it in 100 different ways, and we already have 100 different thinking processes, so we just make the connection and. That's another thing I love. I love having kind of a body of knowledge that's really been created through innovation and testing and proof outside of yourself that these things work. We're doing this. Yeah. I mean, we're writing the book, The Gap in the Game, for the second book in the series with Hay House.
Yeah,
It's probably 3 weeks. The final, the final. This is for October, the cover's already. It's already selling. We've already sold 1,000 books.
Nice.
Got the cover up. I put it right on Amazon, and Amazon pre-ordered 1,000 books. But it was really interesting working with Ben, because Who Not How was a new concept. I mean. You showed me the diagram 3 years ago, I think 3 years ago or something like that, and you made mention of it. And then, we started playing with it in the program. So bringing Ben in and to be the writer, and that we didn't have that much of a track record yet with Who Not How. So it could be, you could say all sorts of things about it, but The Gap in the Game is 28 years old, and it's not just 20,000; it's 20,000 times 10 people have gotten this idea, we had to approach the book very, very differently. And I said, outside of with Who Not How, you could go out to all sorts of other kind of theories and psychological principles. But I said, Ben, there's some real experts on this that are members of Strategic Coach. And I said, you're not going to find too many people in the world who kind of grasp what this stuff. So we've had to, kind of look at the book differently. But it's really, really in great shape now. I mean, it's really moving forward. So, I'm very excited. But how you measure really makes a difference. I mean, you measure backwards, you measure against the ideal. I said, I see a lot of people who are great achievers, but I can tell right off the bat they're not happy with their achievement.
And I think that's the. Well, that's part of the thing of not, setting off on the path that without pushing the accelerator pedal and knowing where that's going, what it's going to look like at the end. That's really interesting.
You got to be happy with the activity.
Yes. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, you need destinations. You need destinations. But I have to tell you, the more you can just enjoy the experience of being on the trip today. I think that you're going to be a lot happier.
And it's, you know, it feels like I saw somebody breaking down the wisdom of row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
Yep.
That's what it comes down to.
That's it. That's a great wrap up.
It really is.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, but well, and I think, you know, we can go off on this, but there's a fundamental shift, and I think there's been more of a fundamental shift from mainland conditions to Cloudlandia conditions mm-hmm. over the last year than in the previous 10 years before that.
Oh,
I think
absolutely.
We've made a sudden big shift. Not everybody,
yeah.
not everybody, but
no.
I think people with the greatest, what I would say, value creation ambitions made a shift over the last year.
We've got, I'm just doing the calculation. So next, yes, we'll be here next, no, I won't
Sunday.
Be here next Sunday.
Okay.
My birthday is on Monday, and we're going away
yes.
for some free days. And then you've got a birthday coming up too.
But I'll be here.
They never stop. Yeah, you'll be here.
Yeah.
You'll be here.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
All right, 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Okay, Dan.
Again. Okay,
thanks. Bye.